the daylight can reach. Alex shone his torch into the hole. The beam went about 50 meters, but the shaft went further. He found a pebble and dropped it in. At least 10 seconds passed before the pebble rattled against something far below. A rusty ladder ran down the side of the shaft. Alex checked that the quad was out of sight, then looped the rope over his shoulder and shoved the torch into his belt. He didn't enjoy climbing into the hole. The metal rungs were ice cold against his hands, and his shoulders had barely sunk beneath the level of the ground before the light was blotted out, and he felt himself being sucked into a darkness, so total that he couldn't even be sure he had eyes. But he couldn't climb and hold onto the torch. He just had to feel his way, a hand, then a foot, descending further and ever further, until at last his heel struck the ground, and he knew he had reached the bottom of the Kernowek shaft. He looked up. He could just make out the entrance he had climbed through, small, round, as distant as the moon, breathing heavily, trying to fight off the sense of claustrophobia. He pulled out the torch and flicked it on. The beam leapt out of his hand, pointing the way ahead and throwing pure white light onto his immediate surroundings. Alex was at the start of a long tunnel, the uneven walls and ceiling held back by wooden beams. The floor was already damp, and a sheen of salt water hung in the air. It was cold in the mine. He had known it would be, and before he moved, he pulled on the jersey he had bought, then chalked a large X on the wall. That had been a good idea, too. Whatever happened down here, he wanted to be sure he could find his way back. At last he was ready. He took 2 steps forward, away from the vertical shaft and into the start of the tunnel, and immediately felt the weight of the solid rock, soil and remaining streaks of tin bearing down on him. It was horrible here. It really was like being buried alive, and it took all his strength to force himself on. After about 50 paces, he came to a second tunnel, branching off to the left. He took out the photocopied map and examined it in the torchlight. According to Ian Ryder, this was where he had to turn off. He swung the torch round and followed the tunnel, which slanted downwards, taking him deeper and deeper into the earth. There was absolutely no sound in the mine, apart from his own rasping breath, the crunch of his footsteps, and the quickening thud of his heart. It was as if the blackness was wiping out sound as well as vision. Alex opened his mouth and called out, just to hear something. But his voice sounded small, and only reminded him of the huge weight above his head. This tunnel was in bad repair. Some of the beams had snapped and fallen in, and as he passed, a trickle of gravel hit his neck and shoulders, reminding him that the Dosmari mine had been kept locked for a reason. It was a hellish place. It could collapse at any time. The path took him ever deeper. He could feel the pressure pounding in his ears, and the darkness seemed even thicker and more oppressive. He came to a tangle of iron and wire, some sort of machine long ago buried and forgotten. He climbed over it too quickly, cutting his leg on a piece of jagged metal. He stood still for a few seconds, forcing himself to slow down. He knew he couldn't panic. If you panic, you'll get lost. Think what you're doing. Be careful. 1 step at a time.
Okay, okay,
he whispered the words to reassure himself, then continued forward. Now he emerged into a sort of wide circular chamber, formed by the meeting of 6 different tunnels, all coming together in a star shape. The widest of these slanted in from the left with the remains of a railway track. He swung the torch and picked out a couple of wooden wagons, which must have been used to carry equipment down or tin back up to the surface. Checking the maps, he was tempted to follow the railway, which seemed to offer a shortcut across the route that Ian Ryder had drawn. But he decided against it. His uncle had turned the corner and gone back on himself. There had to be a reason. Alex made another 2 chalk crosses, one for the tunnel he had left, another for the one he was entering. He went on. This new tunnel quickly became lower and narrower until Alex couldn't walk unless he crouched. The floor was very wet here, with pools of water reaching his ankles. He remembered how near he was to the sea, and that brought another unpleasant thought. What time was high tide? And when the water rose, what would happen inside the mine? Alex suddenly had a vision of himself trapped in blackness, with water rising up his chest, his neck, over his face. He stopped and forced himself to think of something else. Down here, on his own, far beneath the surface of the earth, he couldn't make an enemy of his imagination. The tunnel curved, then joined a second railway line. This one bent and broken, covered here and there in rubble which must have fallen from above. But the metal tracks made it easier to move forward, picking up and reflecting the torch. Alex followed them all the way to a junction with the main railway. It had taken him 30 minutes, and he was almost back to where he had started, but shining the torch around him, he saw why Ian Ryder had sent him the long way round. There had been a tunnel collapse. About 30 meters up the line, the main railway was blocked. He crossed the tracks, still following the maps, and stopped. He looked at the paper, then again at the way ahead. It was impossible. And yet there was no mistake. He had come to a small round tunnel, dipping steeply down. But after 10 meters, the tunnel simply stopped, with what looked like a sheet of metal barring the way. Alex picked up a stone and threw it. There was a splash. Now he understood. The tunnel was completely submerged in water as black as ink. The water had risen up to the ceiling of the tunnel, so that even assuming he could swim in temperatures that must be close to zero, he would be unable to breathe. After all his hard work, after all the time he had spent underground, there was no way forward. Alex turned. He was about to leave, but even as he swung the torch round, the beam picked up something lying in a heap on the ground. He went over to it and leaned down. It was a diver's dry suit, and it looked brand new. Alex walked back to the water's edge and examined it with the torch. This time he saw something else. A rope had been tied to a rock. It slanted diagonally into the water and disappeared. Alex knew what it meant. Ian Ryder had swum through the submerged tunnel. He had worn a dry suit, and he had managed to fix a rope to guide him through. Obviously, he had planned to come back. That was why he had left the padlock open. It seemed that once again Alex had been helped by the dead man. The question was, did he have the nerve to go on? He picked up the dry suit. It was too big for him, although it would probably keep out the worst of the chill. But the cold wasn't the only problem. The tunnel might run for 10 meters. It might run for 100. How could he be sure that Ian Ryder hadn't used scuba equipment to swim through? If Alex went down there into the water and ran out of breath halfway, he would drown, pinned underneath the rock in the freezing blackness. Couldn't imagine a worse way to die. But he had come so far, and according to the map, he was nearly there. Alex swore. This was not fun. At that moment, he wished he had never heard of Alan Blunt, Sail Enterprises, or the Stormbreaker. But he couldn't go back. If his uncle had done it, so could he. Gritting his teeth, he pulled on the dry suit. It was cold, clammy, and uncomfortable. He zipped it up. He hadn't taken off his ordinary clothes, and perhaps that helped. The suit was loose in places, but he was sure it would keep the water out. Moving quickly now, afraid that if he hesitated he would change his mind, Alex approached the water's edge. He reached out and took the rope in one hand. It would be faster swimming with both hands, but he didn't dare risk it. Getting lost in the underwater tunnel would be as bad as running out of air. The result would be exactly the same. He had to keep hold of the rope to allow it to guide him through. Alex took several deep breaths, hyperventilating and oxygenating his blood, knowing it would give him a few precious extra seconds. Then he plunged in. The cold was ferocious, a hammer blow that nearly forced the air out of his lungs. The water pounded at his head, swirling round his nose and eyes. His fingers were instantly numb. His whole system felt the shock. But the dry suit was holding, sealing in at least some of his body warmth. Clinging to the rope, he kicked forward. He had committed himself. There could be no going back. Pull, kick, pull, kick. Alex had been underwater for less than a minute, but already his lungs were feeling the strain. The roof of the tunnel was scraping his shoulders, and he was afraid that it would tear through the dry suit and gouge his skin as well. But he didn't dare slow down. The freezing cold was sucking the strength out of him. Pull and kick, pull and kick. How long had he been under? 90 seconds? 100? His eyes were tight shut, but if he opened them, there would be no difference. He was in a black, swirling, freezing version of hell, and his breath was running out. He pulled himself forward along the rope, burning the skin off the palms of his hands. He must have been swimming for almost 2 minutes. It felt closer to 10. He had to open his mouth and breathe, even if it was water that would rush into his throat. A silent scream exploded inside him. Pull, kick, pull, kick. And then the rope tilted upwards, and he felt his shoulders come clear, and his mouth was wrenched open in a great gasp as he breathed air. And he knew that he had made it, perhaps with only seconds to spare. But made it to where? Alex couldn't see anything. He was floating in utter darkness, unable to see even where the water ended. He had left the torch on the other side, but he knew that even if he wanted to, he didn't have the strength to go back. He had followed the trail left by a dead man. It was only now that he realized it might lead only to the grave. Chapter 12. Behind the Door. Alex swam slowly forward, completely blind, afraid that at any moment he would crack his skull against rock. Despite the dry suit, he was beginning to feel the chill of the water, and knew he had to find his way out soon. His hand brushed against something, but his fingers were too numb to tell what it was. He reached out and pulled himself forward. His feet touched the bottom. And it was then that he realized. He could see. Somehow, from somewhere, light was seeping into the area beyond the submerged tunnel. Slowly, his vision adjusted itself. Waving his hand in front of his face, he could just make out his fingers. He was holding on to a wooden beam, a collapsed roof support. He closed his eyes, then opened them again. The darkness had retreated, showing him a crossroads cut into the rock. The meeting place of three tunnels. The fourth, behind him, was the one that was flooded. As vague as the light was, it gave him strength. Using the beam as a makeshift jetty, he clambered onto the rock. At the same time, he became aware of a soft throbbing sound. He couldn't be sure if it was near or far, but he remembered what he had heard under Block D, in front of the metal door, and he knew that he had arrived. He stripped off the dry suit. Fortunately, it had kept the water out. The main part of his body was dry, but ice-cold water was still dripping out of his hair, down his neck, and his trainers and socks were sodden. When he moved forward, his feet squelched, and he had to take his trainers off and shake them out before he could go on. Ian Ryder's map was still folded in his pocket, but he no longer had any need of it. All he had to do was follow the light. He went straight forward to another intersection, then turned right. The light was so bright now that he could actually make out the color of the rock, dark brown and gray. The throbbing was also getting louder, and Alex could feel a rush of warm air streaming down towards him. He moved forward cautiously, wondering what he was about to come to. He turned a corner, and suddenly the rock on both sides gave way to new brick, with metal grills set at intervals just above the level of the floor. The old mine shaft had been converted, and it was being used as the outlet for some sort of air conditioning system. The light that had guided Alex was coming out of the grills. He knelt beside the first of these and looked through into a large white-tiled room, a laboratory, with complicated glass and steel equipment laid out over work surfaces. The room was empty. Tentatively, Alex took hold of the grill, but it was firmly secured, bolted into the rock face. The second grill belonged to the same room. It was also screwed on tight. Alex continued up the tunnel to a third grill. This one looked into a storage room filled with the silver boxes that Alex had seen being delivered by the submarine the night before. He took the grill in both hands and pulled. It came away from the rock easily, and looking closer, he understood why. Ian Ryder had been here ahead of him. He had cut through the bolts which had held it in place. Alex set the grill down silently. He felt sad. Ian Ryder had found his way through the mine, drawn the map, swum through the submerged tunnel, and opened the grill all on his own. Alex wouldn't have got nearly as far as this without his help, and he wished now that he had known his uncle a little better, and perhaps admired him a little more before he died. Carefully, he began to squeeze through the rectangular hole and lower himself into the room. At the last minute, lying on his stomach with his feet dangling below, he reached for the grill and set it back in place. Provided nobody looked too closely, they wouldn't see anything wrong. He dropped down to the ground and landed, cat-like, on the balls of his feet. The throbbing was louder now, coming from somewhere outside. It would cover any noise he made. He went over to the nearest of the silver boxes and examined it. This time it clicked open in his hands, but when he looked inside, it was empty. Whatever had been delivered was already in use. He checked for cameras, then crossed to the door. It was unlocked. He opened it, 1 centimeter at a time, and peered out. The door led onto a wide corridor with an automatic sliding door at each end, and a silver handrail running its full length. 1900 hours. Red shift to assembly line, blue shift to decontamination. The voice rang out over a loud speaker system, neither male nor female, emotionless, inhuman. Alex glanced at his watch. It was already 7 o'clock in the evening. It had taken him longer than he'd thought to get through the mine. He stole forward. It wasn't exactly a passage that he had found. It was more an observation platform. He reached the rail and looked down. Alex hadn't had any idea what he would find behind the metal door, but what he was seeing now was far beyond anything he could have imagined. It was a huge chamber, the walls, half-naked rock, half-polished steel, lined with computer equipment, electronic meters, machines that blinked and flickered with a life of their own. It was staffed by 40 or 50 people, some in white coats, others in overalls, all wearing armbands of different colors, red, yellow, blue, and green. Arc lights beamed down from above. Armed guards stood at each doorway, watching the work with blank faces. For this was where the Stormbreakers were being assembled. The computers were being slowly carried in a long, continuous line along a conveyor belt, past the various scientists and technicians. The strange thing was that they already looked finished, and of course they had to be. Sale had told him. They were actually being shipped out during the course of that afternoon and night. So what last-minute adjustment was being made here in this secret factory? And why was so much of the production line hidden away? What Alex had seen on his tour of Sale Enterprises had only been the tip of the iceberg. The main body of the factory was here, underground. He looked more closely. He remembered the Stormbreaker that he had used, and now he noticed something that he hadn't seen then. A strip of plastic had been drawn back in the casing above each of the screens to reveal a small compartment, cylindrical and about 5 centimeters deep. The computers were passing underneath a bizarre machine, cantilevers, wires, and hydraulic arms. Opaque silver test tubes were being fed along a narrow cage, moving forward as if to greet the computers, 1 tube for each computer. There was a meeting point. With infinite precision, the tubes were lifted out, brought round, and then dropped into the exposed compartments. After that, the Stormbreakers were accelerated forward. A second machine closed and heat-sealed the plastic strips. By the time the computers reached the end of the line, where they were packed into red and white Sale Enterprises boxes, the compartments were completely invisible. A movement caught his eye, and Alex looked beyond the assembly line and through a huge window into the chamber next door. 2 men in spacesuits were walking clumsily together, as if in slow motion. They stopped. An alarm began to sound, and suddenly they disappeared in a cloud of white steam. Alex remembered what he had just heard. Were they being decontaminated? But if the Stormbreaker was based on the round processor, there couldn't possibly be any need for such an extreme. And anyway, this was like nothing Alex had ever seen before. If the men were being decontaminated, what were they being decontaminated from?
Agent Grigorovich, report to the biocontainment zone. This is a call for Agent Grigorovich.
A lean, fair-haired figure, dressed in black, detached himself from the assembly line and walked languidly towards a door that slid open to receive him.
For the second time, Alex found himself looking at the Russian contract killer, Yasin Grigorovich. What was going on? Alex thought back to the submarine and the vacuum-sealed boxes. Of course! Yasin had brought the test tubes that were even now being inserted into the computers. The test tubes were some sort of weapon that he was using to sabotage them. No, that wasn't possible. Back in Port Talon, the librarian had told him that Ian Ryder had been asking for books about computer viruses. Viruses? Decontamination? The biocontainment zone? Understanding came, and with it, something cold and solid jabbing into the back of his neck. Alex hadn't even heard the door open behind him, but he slowly stiffened as a voice spoke softly into his ear. Stand up. Keep your hands by your sides. If you make any sudden moves, I'll shoot you in the head. He looked round slowly. A single guard stood behind him, a gun in his hand. It was the sort of thing Alex had seen 1,000 times in films and on television, and he was shocked by how different the reality was. The gun was a Browning automatic pistol, and one twitch of the guard's finger would send a 9mm bullet shattering through his skull and into his brain. The very touch of it made him feel sick. He stood up. The guard was in his 20s, pale-faced and puzzled. Alex had never seen him before, but more importantly, he had never seen Alex. He hadn't expected to come across a boy. That might help. Who are you? He asked. What are you doing here? I'm staying with Mr. Sale, Alex said. He stared at the gun. Why are you pointing that at me? I'm not doing anything wrong. He sounded pathetic. Little boy lost. But it had the desired effect. The guard hesitated, slightly lowering the gun. At that moment, Alex struck. It was another classic karate blow, this time twisting his body round and driving his elbow into the side of the guard's head just below his ear. He had almost certainly knocked him out with a single punch, but he couldn't take any chances and followed it through with a knee to the groin. The guard folded up, his pistol falling to the ground. Quickly, Alex dragged him back, away from the railing. He looked down. Nobody had seen what had happened. But the guard wouldn't be unconscious long, and Alex knew he had to get out of there, not just back up to ground level, but out of Sale Enterprises itself. He had to contact Mrs. Jones. He still didn't know how or why, but he knew now that the Stormbreakers had been turned into killing machines. There were less than 17 hours until the launch at the Science Museum. Somehow Alex had to stop it from happening. He ran. The door at the end of the passage slid open, and he found himself in a curving white corridor with windowless offices built into what must be yet more shafts of the Dosmari mine. He knew he couldn't go back the way he had come. He was too tired, and even if he could find his way through the mine, he'd never be able to manage the swim a second time. His only chance was the door that had first led him here. It led to the metal staircase that would bring him to D Block. There was a telephone in his room. Failing that, he could use the Game Boy to transmit a message. But MI6 had to know what he had found out. He reached the end of the corridor, then ducked back as three guards appeared, walking together towards a set of double doors. Fortunately, they hadn't seen him. Nobody knew he was there. He was going to be all right. And then the alarm went off, a klaxon barking electronically along the corridors, leaping out from the corners, echoing everywhere. Overhead, a light began to flash red. The guards wheeled round and saw Alex. Unlike the guard on the observation platform, they didn't hesitate. As Alex dived headfirst through the nearest door, they brought up their machine guns and fired. Bullets slammed into the wall beside him and ricocheted along the passageway. Alex landed flat on his stomach and kicked out, slamming the door behind him. He straightened up, found a bolt, and rammed it home. A second later, there was an explosive hammering on the other side as the guards fired at the door. But it was solid metal. It would hold. He was standing on a gantry leading down to a tangle of pipes and cylinders, like the boiler room of a ship. The alarm was as loud here as it had been by the main chamber. It seemed to be coming from everywhere. Alex leapt down the staircase 3 steps at a time and skidded to a halt, searching for a way out. He had a choice of 3 corridors. But then he heard the rattle of feet, and knew that his choice had just become 2. He wished now that he had thought to pick up the Browning automatic. He was alone and unarmed, the only duck in the shooting gallery, with guns everywhere and no way out. Was this what MI6 had trained him for? If so, 11 days hadn't been enough. He ran on, weaving in and out of the pipes, trying every door he came to. A room with more spacesuits hanging on hooks, a shower room, another larger laboratory with a second door leading out, and in the middle, a glass tank shaped like a barrel and filled with green liquid. Tangles of rubber tubing sprouting out of the tank, trays filled with test tubes all around. The barrel-shaped tank, the trays. Alex had seen them before, as vague outlines on his Game Boy. He must have been standing on the other side of the second door. He ran over to it. It was locked from the inside, electronically, by the glass identification plate against the wall. He would never be able to open it. He was trapped. Footsteps approached. Alex just had time to hide himself on the floor, underneath one of the work surfaces, before the first door was thrown open and two more guards ran into the laboratory. They took a quick look around, without seeing him.
"Not here," one of them said. "You better go up."
One guard walked out the way he had come. The other went over to the second door and placed his hand on the glass panel. There was a green glow, and the door buzzed loudly. The guard threw it open and disappeared. Alex rolled forward as the door swung shut and just managed to get his hand into the crack. He waited a moment, then stood up. He pulled the door open. As he had hoped, he was looking out into the unfinished passageway where he'd been surprised by Nadia Volle. The guard had already gone on ahead. Alex slipped out, closing the door behind him, cutting off the sound of the klaxon. He made his way up the metal stairs and through a swing door. He was grateful to find himself back in the fresh air. The sun had already set, but across the lawn the airstrip was ablaze, artificially illuminated by the sort of lights Alex had seen on football pitches. There were about a dozen lorries parked next to each other. Men were loading them up with heavy, square, red and white boxes. The cargo plane that Alex had seen when he arrived rumbled down the runway and lurched into the air. Alex knew he was looking at the end of the assembly line. The red and white boxes were the same ones he had seen in the underground chamber. The Stormbreakers, complete with their deadly secret, were being loaded up and delivered. By morning they would be all over the country. Keeping low, he ran past the fountain and across the grass. He thought about making for the main gate, but he knew that was hopeless. The guards would have been alerted. They'd be waiting for him. Nor could he climb the perimeter fence, not with the razor wire stretched out across the top. No. His own room seemed the best answer. The telephone was there. And so were his only weapons, the few gadgets that Smithers had given him 4 days, or was it 4 years, ago. He entered the house through the kitchen, the same way he had left it the night before. It was only 8 o'clock, but the whole place seemed to be deserted. He ran up the staircase and along the corridor to his room, on the first floor. Slowly he opened the door. It seemed his luck was holding out. There was nobody there. Without turning on the light, he went inside and snatched up the telephone. The line was dead. Never mind. He found his Game Boy, all 4 cartridges, his yo-yo and zit cream, and crammed them into his pockets. He had already decided not to stay there. It was too dangerous. He would find somewhere to hide out. Then he would use the Nemesis cartridge to contact MI6. He went back to the door and opened it. With a shock, he saw Mr. Grin standing in the hallway, looking hideous with his white face, his ginger hair, and his mauve, twisted smile. Alex reacted quickly, striking out with the heel of his right hand. But Mr. Grin was quicker. He seemed to shimmy to one side. Then his hand shot out, the side of it driving into Alex's throat. Alex gasped for breath, but no breath came. The butler made an inarticulate sound and lashed out a second time. Alex got the impression that behind the livid scars, he really was grinning, enjoying himself. He tried to avoid the blow, but Mr. Grin's fist hit him square on the jaw. He was spun into the bedroom, falling backwards. He never even remembered hitting the floor.
Chapter 13. The School Bully. They came for Alex the following morning. He had spent the night handcuffed to a radiator in a small dark room with a single barred window. It might once have been a coal cellar. When Alex opened his eyes, the grey first light of the morning was just creeping in. He closed them and opened them again,
His head was thumping, and the side of his face was swollen where Mr. Grin had hit him. His arms were twisted behind him, and the tendons in his shoulders were on fire. But worse than all of this was his sense of failure. It was the 1st of April, the day when the Stormbreakers would be unleashed, and Alex was helpless. He was the April Fool. It was just before 9 o'clock when the door opened, and two guards came in with Mr. Grin behind them. The handcuffs were unlocked, and Alex was forced to his feet. Then, with a guard holding him on each side, he was marched out of the room and up a flight of stairs. He was still in Sale's house. The stairs led to the hall with its huge painting of Judgment Day. Alex looked at the figures writhing in agony on the canvas. If he was right, the image would soon be repeated all over England. And it would happen in just 3 hours' time. The guards half-dragged him through a doorway and into the room with the aquarium. There was a high-backed wooden chair in front of it. Alex was forced to sit down. His hands were cuffed behind him again. The guards left. Mr. Grin remained. He heard the sound of feet on the spiral staircase, saw the leather shoes coming down, before he saw the man who wore them. Then Herod Sale appeared, dressed in an immaculate pale grey silk suit. Blunt and the people at MI6 had been suspicious of the Middle Eastern multi-millionaire from the very start. They'd always thought he had something to hide, but even they had never guessed the truth. He wasn't a friend of Alex's country. He was its worst enemy.
"Three questions," Sale snapped. His voice was utterly cold. "Who are you? Who sent you? How much do you know?"
"I don't know what you're talking about," Alex said.
Sale sighed. If there had been anything comical about him when Alex had first seen him, it had completely evaporated. His face was bored and businesslike. His eyes were ugly, full of menace.
"We have very little time," he said. "Mr. Grin?"
Mr. Grin went over to one of the display cases and took out a knife, razor sharp, with a serrated edge. He held it up close to his face, his eyes gleaming.
"I have already told you Mr. Grin used to be an expert with knives," Sale continued. "He still is. Tell me what I want to know, Alex, or he will cause you more pain than you could begin to imagine. And don't try to lie to me, please. Just remember what happens to liars, particularly to their tongues."
Mr. Grin took a step closer. The blade flashed, catching the light.
"My name is Alex Ryder," Alex said.
"Ryder's son?"
"His nephew."
"Who sent you here?"
"The same people who sent him."
There was no point in lying. It didn't matter anymore. The stakes had become too high.
MI6.
Sale laughed without any sign of humor.
"They sent 14-year-old boys to do their dirty work. Not very English, I'd have said. Not cricket. What?"
He had adopted an exaggerated English accent. Now he walked forward and sat down behind the desk.
"And what of my third question, Alex? How much have you found out?"
Alex shrugged, trying to look casual to hide the fear he was really feeling. "I know enough," he said.
"Go on."
Alex took a breath. Behind him, the jellyfish drifted past like a poisonous cloud. He could see it out of the corner of his eye. He tugged at the handcuffs, wondering if it would be possible to break the chair. There was a sudden flash, and the knife that Mr. Grin had been holding was suddenly quivering in the back of the chair, a hair's breadth from his head. The edge of the blade had actually nicked the skin of his neck. He felt a trickle of blood slide over his collar.
"You're keeping us waiting," Herod Sale said.
"All right. When my uncle was here, he got interested in viruses. He asked about them at the local library. I thought he was talking about computer viruses. That was the natural assumption. But I was wrong. I saw what you were doing last night. I heard them talking on the speaker system. Decontamination and biocontainment zones. They were talking about biological warfare. You've got hold of some sort of real virus. It came here in test tubes, packed into silver boxes, and you put them into the Stormbreakers. I don't know what happens next. I suppose when the computers are turned on, people die. They're in schools, so it'll be school children, which means you're not the saint everyone thinks you are, Mr. Sale. A mass murderer. A bloody psycho, I suppose you might say."
Herod Sale clapped his hands softly together.
You've done very well, Alex, he said. I congratulate you. And I feel you deserve a reward. So I'm going to tell you everything. In a way, it's appropriate that MI6 should have sent me a real English schoolboy. Because, you see, there's nothing in the world I hate more. Oh, yes.
His face twisted with anger, and for a moment, Alex could see the madness alive in his eyes.
You bloody snobs with your stuck-up schools and your stinking English superiority. But I'm going to show you all.
He stood up and walked over to Alex. I came to this country 40 years ago, he said. I had no money. My family had nothing. But for a freak accident, I would probably have lived and died in Beirut. Better for you if I had. So much better. I was sent here by an American family to be educated. They had friends in North London, and I stayed with them while I went to the local school. You cannot imagine how I was feeling then, to be in London, which I had always believed to be the heart of civilization. To see such wealth, and to know that I was going to be part of it. I was going to be English. To a child born in a Lebanese gutter, it was an impossible dream. But I was soon to learn the reality. Sale leaned forward and yanked the knife out of the chair. He tossed it to Mr. Grin, who caught it and spun it in his hand. From the moment I arrived at the school, I was mocked and bullied. Because of my size, because of the color of my skin, because I couldn't speak English well, because I wasn't one of them. They had names for me. Herod Smell, Goat Boy, the Dwarf. They played tricks on me. Drawing pins on my chair, books stolen and defaced. My trousers ripped off me and hung on the flagpole underneath a Union Jack. Sale shook his head slowly. I had loved that flag when I first came here, he said. But in only weeks I came to hate it. Lots of people are bullied at school, Alex began, and stopped as soon as Sale backhanded him viciously across the face.
I haven't finished, he said.
He was breathing heavily, and there was spittle on his lower lip. Alex could see him reliving the past, and once again he was allowing the past to destroy him.
There were plenty of bullies in that school, he said, but there was one who was worse than any of them. He was a small, schmarmy shrimp of a boy. But his parents were rich, and he had a way with the other children. He knew how to talk his way around them, a politician even then. Oh, yes, he could be charming when he wanted to be, when there were teachers around. But the moment their backs were turned, he was on to me. He used to organize the others. Let's get the goat boy, push his head in the toilet. He had 1,000 ideas to make my life miserable, and he never stopped thinking up more. All the time he goaded me and taunted me, and there was nothing I could do because he was popular and I was a foreigner. And do you know who that boy grew up to be?
I think you're going to tell me anyway, Alex said.
I am going to tell you. Yes, he grew up to be the bloody Prime Minister!
Sale took out a white silk handkerchief and wiped his face. His bald head was gleaming with sweat.
All my life, I've been treated the same way, he continued. No matter how successful I've become, how much money I've made, how many people I've employed, I'm still a joke. I'm still Herod Smell, the goat boy, the Lebanese tramp. Well, for 40 years I've been planning my revenge, and now at last my time has come. Mr. Grin?
Mr. Grin went over to the wall and pressed a button. Alex half expected the snooker table to rise out of the floor, but instead, a panel slid up on every wall to reveal floor-to-ceiling television screens, which immediately flickered into life. On one screen, Alex could see the underground laboratory. On another, the assembly line. On a third, the airstrip, with the last of the lorries on its way out. There were closed-circuit television cameras everywhere, and Sale could see every corner of his kingdom without even leaving the room. No wonder Alex had been discovered so easily.
The Stormbreakers are armed and ready, and yes, you're right, Alex. Each one contains what you might call a computer virus. But that, if you like, is my little April Fool's joke. Because the virus I'm talking about is a form of smallpox. Of course, Alex, it's been genetically modified to make it faster and stronger. More lethal. A spoonful of the stuff would destroy a city, and my Stormbreakers hold much, much more than that. At the moment it's isolated. Quite safe. But this afternoon there's going to be a bit of a party at the Science Museum. Every school in Britain will be joining in, with the school children gathering round their nice, shiny new computers. And at midday, on the stroke of 12, my old friend, the Prime Minister, will make one of his smug, self-serving speeches, and then he'll press a button. He thinks he'll be activating the computers, and in a way, he's right. Pressing the button will release the virus, and by midnight tonight, there will be no more school children in Britain. And the Prime Minister will weep as he remembers the day he first bullied Herod Sale.
You're mad, Alex exclaimed. By midnight tonight, you'll be in jail.
Sale dismissed the thought with a wave of the hand.
I think not. By the time anyone realizes what has happened, I'll be gone. I'm not alone in this, Alex. I have powerful friends who have supported me.
Yasin Grigorovich?
You have been busy. He seemed surprised that Alex knew the name. Yasin is working for the people who have been helping me. Let's not mention any names or even nationalities. You'd be surprised how many countries there are in the world who loathe the English. Most of Europe, just to begin with. But anyway, he clapped his hands and went back to his desk. Now you know the truth. I'm glad I was able to tell you, Alex. You have no idea how much I loathe you. Even when you were playing that stupid game with me, the snooker, I was thinking how much pleasure it would give me to kill you. You're just like the boys I was at school with. Nothing has changed.
You haven't changed, Alex said. His cheek was still smarting where Sale had hit him. But he'd heard enough.
I'm sorry you were bullied at school, he said, but lots of kids get bullied and they don't turn into nutcases. You're really sad, Mr. Sale, and your plan won't work. I've told MI6 everything I know. They'll be waiting for you at the Science Museum. So will the men in white coats.
Sale giggled. Forgive me if I don't believe you, he said. His face was suddenly stone. And perhaps you forget that I warned you about lying to me.
Mr. Grin took a step forward, flipping the knife over so that the blade landed in the flat of his hand.
I'd like to watch you die, Sale said. Unfortunately, I have a pressing engagement in London.
He turned to Mr. Grin.
You can walk with me to the helicopter, then come back here and kill the boy. Make it slow. Make it painful. We should have kept back some smallpox for him, but I'm sure you'll think of something much more creative.
He walked to the door, then stopped and turned to Alex.
Goodbye, Alex. It wasn't a pleasure knowing you, but enjoy your death. And remember, you're only going to be the first.
The door swung shut. Handcuffed to the chair, with a jellyfish floating silently behind him, Alex was left alone. Chapter 14. Deep Water. Alex gave up trying to break free of the chair. His wrists were bruised and bloody where the chain had cut into him, and the cuffs were too tight. After 30 minutes, when Mr. Grin still hadn't come back, he tried to reach the zit cream that Smithers had given him. He knew it would burn through the handcuffs in seconds, and the worst thing was he could actually feel it, where he had put it, in the zipped-up outer pocket of his combat trousers. But although his outstretched fingers were only a few centimeters away, try as he might, he couldn't reach it. It was enough to drive him mad. He had heard the clatter of a helicopter taking off, and knew that Herod Sale must be on his way to London. Alex was still reeling from what he had heard. The multimillionaire was completely insane. What he was planning was beyond belief, a mass murder that would destroy Britain for generations to come. Alex tried to imagine what was about to happen. Tens of thousands of schoolchildren would be sitting in their classes, gathered round their new stormbreakers, waiting for the moment at midday exactly when the Prime Minister would press his button and bring them online. But instead there would be a hiss, and a small cloud of deadly smallpox vapor would be released into the crowded room. And minutes later, all over the country, the dying would begin. Alex had to close his mind to the thought. It was too horrible, and yet it was going to happen in just a couple of hours' time. He was the only person who could stop it, and here he was, tied down, unable to move. The door opened. Alex twisted round, expecting to see Mr. Grin. But it was Nadia Vola who hurried in, closing the door behind her.
Her pale, round face seemed flushed, and her eyes, behind the glasses, were afraid. She came over to him. Alex! What do you want? Alex recoiled from her as she leaned over him. Then there was a click, and to his astonishment, his hands came free. She had unlocked the handcuffs. He stood up, wondering what was going on.
Alex, listen to me,
Vora said. The words were tumbling quickly and softly out of her yellow-painted lips.
We do not have much time. I'm here to help you. I worked with your uncle, Herr Ehrenreiter.
Alex stared at her in surprise.
Yes, I am on the same side as you.
But nobody told me. It was better for you not to know. But Alex was confused.
I saw you with the submarine. You knew what Sale was doing. There was nothing I could do, not then. It is too hard to explain. We don't have the time to argue. You want to stop him, no?
I need to find a phone.
All the phones in the house are coded. You cannot use them, but I have a mobile in my office.
Then let's go. Alex was still suspicious. If Nadia Vola had known so much, why hadn't she tried to stop Sale before? On the other hand, she had released him, and Mr. Grin would be back any minute. He had no choice but to trust her. He followed her out of the room, round the corner and up a flight of stairs, to a landing with a statue of a naked woman, some Greek goddess, in the corner. Vola paused for a moment, resting her hand against the statue's arm.
What is it? Alex asked. I feel dizzy. You go on. It's the first door on the left.
Alex went past her along the landing. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw her press down on the statue's arm. The arm moved. A lever. By the time he knew he had been tricked, it was too late. He yelled out as the floor underneath him swung round on a hidden pivot. He tried to stop himself falling, but there was nothing he could do. He crashed onto his back and slid down, through the floor and into a black plastic tunnel which corkscrewed beneath him. As he went, he heard Nadia Vola laugh triumphantly. And then he was gone, desperately trying to find a purchase on the sides, wondering what would be at the end of his fall. 5 seconds later, he found out. The corkscrew spat him out. He fell briefly through the air and splashed into cold water. For a moment, he was blinded, fighting for air. Then he rose to the surface and found himself in a huge glass tank filled with water and rocks. That was when he realized, with horror, exactly where he was. Vola had deposited him in the tank with the giant jellyfish, Herod Sale's Portuguese man-o-war. It was a miracle that he hadn't crashed right into it. He could see it in the far corner of the tank, its dreadful tentacles with their hundreds of stinging cells twisting and spiraling in the water. There was nothing between him and it. Alex fought back the panic, forced himself to keep still. He realized that thrashing about in the water would only create the current that would bring the creature over to him. The jellyfish had no eyes. It didn't know he was there. It wouldn't, couldn't, attack. But eventually, it would reach him. The tank he was in was huge, at least 10 meters deep and 20 or 30 meters long. The glass rose above the level of the water, far out of his reach. There was no way he could climb out. Looking down through the water, he could see light. He realized he was looking into the room he had just left, Herod Sale's private office. There was a movement. Everything was vague and distorted through the rippling water. And the door opened. 2 figures walked in. Alex could barely make them out, but he knew who they were. Fraulein Vola and Mr. Grin. They stood together in front of the tank. Vola was holding what looked like a mobile telephone in her hand.
I hope you can hear me, Alex.
The German woman's voice rang out from a speaker somewhere above his head.
I am sure you will have seen by now that there is no way out of the tank. You can tread water maybe for 1 hour, maybe for 2. Others have lasted for longer. What is your record, Mr. Grin?
No.
5.5 hours, yes. But soon you will get tired, Alex. You will drown. Or perhaps it will be fast, and you will drift into the embrace of our friend. You see him, no? It's not an embrace to be desired. It will kill you. The pain, I think, will be beyond the imagination of a child. It is a pity, Alex Ryder, that MI6 chose to send you here. They will not be seeing you again.
The voice clicked off. Alex kicked in the water, keeping his head above the surface, his eyes fixed on the jellyfish. There was another blurred movement on the other side of the glass. Mr. Grin had left the room, but Vola had stayed behind. She wanted to watch him die. Alex looked up. The tank was lit from above by a series of neon strips, but they were too high to reach. Beneath him he heard a click and a soft whirring sound. Almost at once he became aware that something had changed. The jellyfish was moving. He could see the translucent cone with its dark mauve tip heading towards him. Underneath the creature, the tentacles slowly danced. He swallowed water and realized he had opened his mouth to cry out. Vola must have turned on the artificial current. That was what was making the jellyfish move. Desperately, he kicked out with his feet, moving away from it, surging through the water on his back. One tentacle floated up and draped itself over his foot. If he hadn't been wearing trainers, he would have been stung. Could the stinging cells penetrate his clothes? Almost certainly. His trainers were the only protection he had. He reached the back corner of the aquarium and paused, one hand against the glass. He already knew that what Vola had said was true. If the jellyfish didn't get him, tiredness would. He had to fight every second to stay afloat, and sheer terror was sapping his strength. The glass. He pushed against it, wondering if he could break it. Perhaps there was a way. He checked the distance between himself and the jellyfish, took a deep breath, and dived down to the bottom of the pool. He could see Nadia Vola, watching. Although she was a blur to him, he would be crystal clear to her. She didn't move, and Alex realized with despair that she had expected him to do just this. He swam to the rocks and looked for one small enough to bring to the surface, but the rocks were too heavy. He found one about the size of his own head, but it refused to move. Vola hadn't tried to stop him because she knew that all the rocks were set in concrete. Alex was running out of breath. He twisted round and pushed himself up towards the surface, only seeing at the last second that the jellyfish had somehow drifted above him. He screamed, bubbles erupting out of his mouth. The tentacles were right over his head. Alex contorted his body and managed to stay down, flailing madly with his legs to propel himself sideways. His shoulder slammed into the nearest of the rocks, and he felt the pain shudder through him. Clutching his arm in his hand, he backed into another corner and rose up, gasping for breath as his head broke through the surface of the water. He couldn't break the glass. He couldn't climb out. He couldn't avoid the touch of the jellyfish forever. Although he had brought all the gadgets Smithers had given him, none of them could help him. And then Alex remembered the cream. He let go of his arm and ran a finger up the side of the aquarium. The tank was a marvel of engineering. Alex had no idea how much pressure the water was exerting on the huge plates of glass, but the whole thing was held together by a framework of iron girders that fitted round the corners on both the inside and outside of the glass. The metal faces held together by rivets. Treading water, he unzipped his pocket and took out the tube. Zipped clean for healthier skin. If Nadia Vola could see what he was doing, she would think he had gone mad. The jellyfish was drifting towards the back of the aquarium. Alex waited a few moments, then swam forward and dived for a second time. There didn't seem to be very much of the cream, given the thickness of the girders and the size of the tank. But Alex remembered the demonstration Smithers had given him. How little he had used. Would the cream even work underwater? There was no point worrying about that now. Alex held the tube against the metal corners at the front of the tank, and did his best to squeeze a long line of cream all the way down the length of the metal, using his other hand to rub it in round the rivets. He kicked his feet, propelling himself across to the other side. He didn't know how long he would have before the cream took effect, and anyway, Nadia Vola was already aware that something was wrong. Alex saw that she had stood up again, and was speaking into a phone, perhaps calling for help. He had used half the tube on one side of the tank. He used the second half on the other. The jellyfish was hovering above him, the tentacles reaching out as if to grab hold of him and stop him. How long had he been underwater? His heart was pounding. And what would happen when the metal broke? He just had time to come up and take one breath before he found out. Even underwater, the cream had burned through the rivets on the inside of the tank. The glass had separated from the girders and, with nothing to hold it back, the huge pressure of water had smashed it open like a door caught in the wind. Alex didn't see what happened. He didn't have time to think. The world spun and he was thrown forward as helpless as a cork in a waterfall. The next few seconds were a twisting nightmare of rushing water and exploding glass. Alex didn't dare open his eyes. He felt himself being hurled forward, slammed into something, then sucked back again. He was sure he had broken every bone in his body. Now he was underwater. He struggled to find air. His head broke through the surface, but even so, when he finally opened his mouth, he was amazed he could actually breathe. The front of the tank had blown off, and thousands of liters of water had cascaded into Herod Sayle's office. The water had smashed the furniture and blown the windows out. It was still draining away through the floor. Bruised and dazed, Alex stood up, water curling round his ankles. Where was the jellyfish? He had been lucky that the two of them hadn't become tangled up in the sudden eruption of water. But it could still be close. There might still be enough water in Sayle's office to allow it to reach him. Alex backed into a corner of the room, his whole body taut. Then he saw it. Nadia Voller had been less fortunate. She had been standing in front of the glass when the girders broke, and she hadn't been able to get out of the way in time. She was lying on her back, her legs limp and broken. The Portuguese man-o-war was all over her. Part of it was sitting on her face, and she seemed to be staring at him through the quivering mass of jelly. Her yellow lips were drawn back in an endless scream. The tentacles were wrapped all around her, hundreds of stinging cells clinging to her arms and legs and chest. Feeling sick, Alex backed away to the door and staggered out into the corridor. An alarm had gone off. He only heard it now, as sound and vision came back to him. The screaming of the siren shook him out of his dazed state. What time was it? Almost 11 o'clock. At least his watch was still working. But he was in Cornwall, at least a 5-hour drive from London, and with the alarms sounding, the armed guards and the razor wire, he'd never make it out of the complex. Find a telephone? No. Voller had probably been telling the truth when she'd said they were blocked. And anyway, how could he get in touch with Alan Blunt or Mrs. Jones at this late stage? They'd already be at the Science Museum. Just 1 hour left. Outside, over the din of the alarm, Alex heard another sound, the splutter and roar of a propeller. He went over to the nearest window and looked out. Sure enough, the cargo plane that had been there when he arrived was preparing to take off. Alex was soaking wet, battered, and almost exhausted, but he knew what he had to do. He spun round and began to run. Chapter 15. 11 o'clock. Alex burst out of the house and stopped in the open air, taking stock of his surroundings. He was aware of alarms ringing, guards running towards him, and two cars, still some distance away, tearing up the main drive, heading for the house. He just hoped that although it was obvious something was wrong, nobody would yet know what it was. They shouldn't be looking for him, at least not yet. That might give him the edge. It looked like he was already too late. Sayle's private helicopter had gone. Only the cargo plane was left. If Alex was going to reach the Science Museum in London in the 59 minutes left to him, he had to be on it. But the cargo plane was already in motion, rolling slowly away from its chocks. In a minute or two, it would go through the pre-flight tests. Then it would take off. Alex looked around and saw an open-top army jeep parked on the drive near the front door. There was a guard standing next to it, a cigarette dropping out of his hand, looking around to see what was happening, but looking the wrong way. Perfect. Alex sprinted across the gravel. He had brought a weapon from the house, one of Sayle's harpoon guns, had floated past him just as he'd left the room, and he'd snatched it up, determined to have something he could use to defend himself with at last. It would have been easy enough to shoot the guard right then, a harpoon in the back, and the jeep would be his. But Alex knew he couldn't do it. Whatever Alan Blunt and MI6 wanted to turn him into, he wasn't ready to shoot in cold blood. Not for his country. Not even to save his own life. The guard looked up as Alex approached and fumbled for the pistol he was wearing in a holster at his belt. He never made it. Alex used the handle of the harpoon gun, swinging it round and up to hit him hard under the chin. The guard crumpled, the pistol falling out of his hand. Alex grabbed it and leapt into the jeep, grateful to see the keys were in the ignition. He turned them and heard the engine start up. He knew how to drive. That was something else Ian Ryder had made sure he'd learned, as soon as his legs were long enough to reach the pedals. The other cars were closing in on him. They must have seen him attack the guard. The plane had wheeled round and was already taxiing up to the start of the runway. He wasn't going to reach it in time. Maybe it was the danger closing in from all sides that sharpened his senses. Maybe it was his close escape from so many dangers before.